Hello and welcome to the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. Blamed as the cause of the COVID pandemic, once the crisis is over, China has a daunting challenge on multiple fronts. On the top of those challenges comes the economy and possible recession. It's yet to be seen how the economic slowdown will affect China's external trade, but any negative trend will have catastrophic consequences for Central Asia. In this episode of Majlis Podcast, I'm surrounded by China in Central Asia experts to find out what are the current trends, what are the future scenarios, and what would all that mean for Central Asia. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Dirk van der Kelle, the Program Director for Policy Research at China Matters Project. Dr. Kelle has just completed his doctoral studies on Chinese economic statecraft in Central Asia. Congratulations, Dr. Kelle. We also have Dr. Gulberna Özcan, a reader in international business and entrepreneurship at the University of London. Dr. Özcan is a veteran China wonk with interest in Central Asia. One of her recent projects was about power in anxiety surrounding China's business interests in Central Asia. Welcome, Dr. Özcan. Also, we have Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us on this very important discussion. But the issue is I don't have a specific topic for today. Since we began thinking about this episode, there was only one thing in my mind, which is the economic calculation of China in the post-COVID-19 era. Given that China is at the center of all these crises that the world is going through, I thought it's obvious that there will be consequences for China, and that could include economic, political, and PR aspects. This will certainly lead Chinese leaders to take certain decisions, and given the nature of government structure in China, these steps have to and must start with the economic calculations. If this is what we are looking at, Central Asia's economic future could be on the turbulent grounds in the years to come. So I already said I don't have a specific topic except to explore what we are really looking at going forward in terms of the implications of China's post-COVID-19 steps to its relations with Central Asia. So let me start by taking brief comments from each of you about the scenarios I have just painted. And let me start with you, Dr. Kelle. By the way, you must be our first guest who is joining us all the way from Australia. So glad to have you. So Dr. Kelle, please comment on a possible post-COVID-19 picture that I have just painted. Please say if I'm exaggerating the whole thing.
Well, thank you for that. And it's a pleasure to be the first Australian guest on the program. When I look at the post-COVID environment in Central Asia from China's perspective, the first thing that jumps out at me is that the basic interests that China has don't change fundamentally, but how each of those interests play out is a little bit different. So I would say there are three main interests that China has in Central Asia. The first one, and this is long-standing, is that the region maintains stability. It doesn't become disrupted or a potential place where, you know, Uyghur terrorists may be able to conduct activities from, and that they just don't have unstable neighbours on their border. The second one is, of course, hydrocarbons. Even with an economic downturn, they still need access to hydrocarbons, and it's quite likely, I think, that gas demand will continue to grow in the medium term, maybe not in the immediate term. And then the third part is asking other countries in the region to help craft a less US-centric regional and global order. That's not something that's unique to Central Asia. If you're in ASEAN, if you're Australia, if you're in South Asia, there are going to be lots of times where the US and the PRC have conflicts either rhetorically or in technology, and you'll be asked to choose one side or another. And a simple example of that will be all the human rights things that we see in Hong Kong, in Xinjiang, over the next few months, on COVID as well, the origins of COVID, the investigation there. There'll be just lots of choices where you have to support one side or another. So they're the basic three things that I see happening. But where COVID changes the debate is on that third one. There's just going to be so much more. The US is gunning for China in a way that wasn't a case even in January. And then the stability side, we see a situation now where debt and economic downturns could make the region less stable, something that for all the troubles that Central Asia has didn't seem nearly as likely a year or two ago. And that's going to be something that China will have to deal with. But of course, they have less economic might to do so at the same time.
So aside from rights in politics, Dr. Ozhan, you look into China's business interests in Central Asia. What are you looking at as the world is headed to sort of a recession with COVID-19 still remaining a factor?
Yes, China's business interests in the region have been expanding, covering almost all sectors of the economy, especially Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, but also spreading to Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan done as well. And I think the COVID-19 outbreak is on the one hand hitting badly these economies and their growth prospects, but on the other hand has provided, with the things happening in the US and the COVID pandemic's various effects also in Europe, that it creates a great propaganda opportunity. And I think China is doing very well in terms of arguing its position. So in terms of the economic scenarios, I would say China will continue to remain in the region, but certainly its demand on oil and gas is declining, and that will have negative consequences. It might even have consequences for political stability and likely to put pressure on the ruling governments, especially in Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. I would say Turkmenistan as the most fragile among all. So I have to stress that the effects are going to be highly asymmetric among Central Asian states.
Yeah, earlier I saw a tweet. I don't know the source for that tweet. Perhaps, Bruce, you might have seen that. There is already a decline in import of Turkmen gas to China by 22%. Have you seen anything like that?
That was bilateral trade overall. Mm. But in Turkmenistan's case, that means gas. So that's how you'd have to read that. Yes, there was. Kazakhstan was the only one that was on the plus side. Otherwise, bilateral trade with China has been down this year across the board for all the Central Asian, except for Kazakhstan, all the Central Asian countries.
Bruce, can you give us some picture of that, some statistics if you have handy?
You know, I don't. Luke Mackey is the one that tweeted that. I remember that, and that, you know, and that's true. And you had to figure that, you know, just starting from the fact that the borders were closed, you know, for health reasons, that right there strangles your trade.
Right.
So it was bound to go down. I mean, every country in the region's been talking about the problems they've been having importing and exporting goods. You know, they'll be fortunate if they can open it up when summer comes, since so much of Central Asian exports are agricultural outside of the hydrocarbon sphere, certainly. You know, but this is going to be a real pivotal moment for the Central Asian government. As mentioned, China has successfully entered Central Asia and diversified its interests in the region. So it's not specifically, not only hydrocarbons, which was our mining, you know, raw materials, which were what lured Chinese investment into the region to start with. But it owns a lot of other things now, you know, to the point where this obviously hurts the Central Asians, that Chinese economy is taking a hit from this. And there's a knock on effect in Central Asia. But at the same time, China is so deep in Central Asia at the moment that the Central Asians don't have anywhere else to go, you know. I mean, after the 2007-2008 economic crisis, Russia never really recovered, you know, to the point where it could provide the kind of financing that it had in Central Asia and be the clear and obvious superpower or power that had some influence in the region. You know, China took over after that, and Russian economy is not going to do very well in the near future. China will probably do better, but won't be able to spend the kind of money that it did in Central Asia. But like I said, at this point, China has so much interest in Central Asia already and has spread out all over the place, that the Central Asians are still going to be dependent upon China. And it should cause a rethinking in the parts of the government on how much they want to keep so much trade and so much dependence on China in the future.
Yeah,
but they have no other choice at the moment.
Yeah, we are going to talk about this in length, Bruce, a little bit later. While you were talking, I just found out the decline in the Chinese import from Turkmenistan included gas and LNG. The source is Reuters. Okay, so from the Central Asian perspective, it's just feel free, whoever wants to jump in that. We were mainly talking about the Chinese thinking here. So what is the thought process in Central Asia? I mean, what are their nightmare scenarios when thinking about the possible setbacks in Chinese business interests with the region? Dr. Kelly, Dr. Ozhan,
I'll jump in there.
Yeah.
The first thing, and it is related to hydrocarbons, I certainly recognize that from the Chinese side, yes, there's a lot of other businesses operating in Central Asia at the moment, but the interest from China in terms of it at a high geopolitical level is still just the hydrocarbons. All the other businesses there are important to Central Asia, but they're not necessarily that important to China in a macro sense. In terms of Central Asia, I mean, the nightmare scenario long term is continued low gas and oil prices. And this is not just because of the exports, but low gas and oil prices globally means that Russia is not going to recover in the same way, and that will affect remittances long term. That's right. The real downside there that matters. And if demand in China is down, or even in Europe, that's going to be an ongoing thing.
But you expect, regardless of Dr. Kelly, itself. You expect demands in China to be down, right? I mean, when we look in
short term, yes, I would think we could potentially see them go up again next year. The gas is something that is being pushed instead of coal and other things like that. And one of the domestic things that are happening in China now is they're going to try and switch to clean energy more quickly than they otherwise would have. And so it's quite possible, I think, that you'll see a switch from coal to gas more quickly. And so the demand, even within a year or two, I think could pick back up again, but at much lower prices than we see at the moment. So even if we're looking at the same volume, we're looking at lower prices. So that's the first thing. The other thing that I would say in terms of overall economic impact, I think this is picking up on what Bruce said, is we're going to see probably, I think actually China have a bigger role rather than a smaller role, because the exports to China for all the industries that China is in the region, there really haven't been any exports outside of hydrocarbons to be of any value. Yes, there's some small amounts of agriculture and other things that have gone, but other export markets like Russia, like Europe, are going to completely dry up for anything beyond that. And then the second point is something that happened before COVID, is the way that China's really been trying to be operating the region has been a little bit different. It's not so much about building infrastructure now and those kind of things. It's about facilitating exports from the region. And some of that is into China. If you look at like cherries in Uzbekistan, agriculture and barley in Kazakhstan, and that's directly in place of things that are coming from Australia, because Australia has its own problems with China at the moment itself, that I think you're actually going to see more industries more reliant on China than was the case before, even if it's just because nowhere else has recovered at the same pace, or has the situation in China is just less bad than everywhere else in the world. And in terms of the scenario for Central Asia, there's very little they can do to change that. They just have to hope that things get better in other parts of the world. And then longer term, if they can try and diversify, it's difficult just given the economic makeup of the countries in the region.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ozan, earlier you were talking about this a little bit. Other than hydrocarbon, what are the other types of business relations that we are talking about here between Central Asia and China? And are you seeing any indicative element, whether there's a decline, whether it's steady, how COVID-19 is factoring as we speak?
Before going on that topic, can I just few things about following on Dirk's point? I think in the broader picture, there is likely to be a retreat from the Belt and Road Initiative, because that project was not for Central Asia. It was designed to open to new ports and have access to European markets. Now, that seems to have been challenged by the COVID in two major ways. One, China doesn't probably not want to spend more on infrastructure investments and possible also other means of losing finances through corrupt, perhaps, business deals in the region. So there will be less of an incentive to spend money on such projects that may not be really connecting these nodes. So I think that will bring a kind of prestige decline in the eyes of some policymakers in Beijing, whether BRI is a feasible and good thing to do through Central Asia. The second point,
Dr. Ozan, before you get into your second point, do you want Dirk to respond to your comments about the BRI? I feel that he has a different perspective about the future of that project.
May I say the second point, because it's related?
Okay.
The second logic of that is, if we assume that global supply chains are going to be restructured, very likely in different ways, either they will get more localized or more nationalized or regional, especially because there are various forms of prejudice about the origin of virus and the spread. We have not yet reached that stage, but everywhere there is a talk of obviously reducing risks in supply chains. That will obviously affect China's exports to the BRI network. So given these uncertainties, I would believe that China will put BRI on hold for a while, especially in terms of its connections in the wider Central Asian region.
Very important point, Dr. Kelly, very briefly.
I completely agree that we won't see the large infrastructure projects that we've seen before. I think that's in the past, and the kind of things that we see now will be different from that. At some point, we may want to talk about how COVID affects debt as well.
Yes, absolutely. So moving on that, let me say a few things about the region's economy. So it is fair to say that the Central Asian governments have wasted years of independence and, of course, global liquidity by not seriously looking into industrial policies and by not really supporting their SME sector. I mean, they have tried various policies, but I think they have not really sincerely addressed this issue. So this crisis basically finds the region with no substantial industrial capacity. As said before, it's essentially commodity-driven economies everywhere, except perhaps in Uzbekistan, we see some diversity, little bit in Kyrgyzstan, but by and large, the economies are not diversified. So they really rely on these commodity exports, and therefore they are really dependent on China and indirectly to Russia. So West's position in that is because of inaccessibility of the region is highly limited and highly ineffectual. So I would say that will continue to be a major problem for the region's economies. I'm sorry, one more important point. When I looked at the trade with China, surprise, surprise, their exports to China actually is on the declining side. So it looks like China is not only the major investor and major, obviously, buyer of their natural commodities, natural gas and oil and etc., but also the major exporter. So in both ways, they are tied to China. And that is very unhealthy when we see situations like this, a highly asymmetric shock hits the region that affects both public health, but also at the same time, economies.
Dr. Uljan, these are really, really important points. Thank you very much for bringing them up. But one point, though, when you say that there has been decline in Central Asian export to China over the past year, is there any data that you could back up your comments with?
Actually, I was looking at the very recent OECD report, COVID-19 Crisis and Response in Central Asia. I just should find these figures. But could you allow me to say this later once I find the figure, because I lost the space in my text?
Sure, that's fine. While you are looking at your sources, let me bring in Bruce Panier, you here. I know you don't stop yourself when you have something to add or comment about something. So I know this is the area you will have a lot to add into our conversation. So please jump in whenever you like to. Meanwhile, I was just wondering, what kind of trends are you seeing in Central Asia in terms of the bilateral trade between the region and China, which could be indicative of where we are headed going forward?
Obviously, you know, I mean, like I said, it was clear that there was going to be a reduction in trade, you know, and really it's not just China. I mean, it's everywhere. So that was going to be a problem. I think natural gas, which is really unfortunate for Turkmenistan, is going to be problematic for a while. You know, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan also contribute. They can contribute up to 10 billion cubic meters of gas a year in the pipeline that goes to China. But China's really looking at LNG a lot closer. And, you know, you can move LNG around a lot. A pipeline is a fixed, you know, it's a fixed structure. It goes from one place to another. And, you know, if you have a need that's not there along the pipeline, you have to build a branch line from the pipeline or something like that. Whereas LNG can be moved around by rail, ship, you know, all kinds of stuff. And China's indicated that that's really where they're going with this. So I think even when the COVID concerns recede a little bit and it looks like it's getting safer, that you might not see China buying as much gas via that pipeline anyway, you know, so that might be one of the casualties of this. A lot of this is obviously, you know, the Central Asians' fault. I mean, I agree with that, with all the comments that they seem to have gotten, you know, like I said, they got way too close to China. You would have thought that after they had a similar relationship with Russia in the 1990s and the first, you know, nearly decade of this century, that they would have learned what it means to be dependent upon one country's economy for your own economies. And they didn't learn the lesson, apparently enough. Right. Admittedly, they're in a disadvantageous location in the world. You know, know, I've said before on shows that really their future is in transit.
Right.
But the downside to that is exactly what's happening now. Hmm. Europe is reassessing its needs from China and its desire, you know, what level of dependency is acceptable.
And America is doing the same thing here, right?
Right, right. But, you know, in the case of Europe, the railways and roadways that were coming from China were really the best ways to get goods from China to Europe. Right. And that meant through Central Asia. Now, if Europe wants less Chinese goods, that means Central Asia has less traffic going through its territories.
Right, so, you know, right. Right. Dr. Uljan, did you...
If you allow me, I give these figures and then we can continue.
Sure.
So this OECD report on the COVID-19 mm-hmm. crisis articulated a number of risks and trends in the region. Mm-hmm. So it says here that by contrast, China accounted for only about 17% of Uzbek exports in 2017. And this share has been falling steadily since 2013.
Mm-hmm.
A similar trend is also being observed in Kyrgyzstan.
Hmm.
So that means these countries are not exporting to China. China both is the major provider of financial and infrastructure investment, but also is able to export its goods and services to Central Asia.
Right.
And obviously it has ownership of, as we know, oil and gas fields as well.
Right, right, right. You know, these are very, very helpful data, Dr. Uljan. So what all these are going to mean for Central Asia? Earlier, Bruce was hinting about this topic. Is there anything that the region could do to prepare itself? What's coming next? What are their options? I guess I would start the discussion talking about whether this crisis changed public perception of China as an ally, as a trading partner, etc. Let's continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions very shortly. But before that, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Dirk van der Kelly, the program director of policy research at China Matters Project. Dr. Gulberna Özcan, a reader in international business and entrepreneurship at the University of London. Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owasi. Bruce is joining us from Prague today. And I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing the possible impact of COVID-19 on China's relations with Central Asia. China is kind of interesting topic, Bruce, when you look into this from Central Asia. It's that dominating giant that you never want to say anything negative that would upset Chinese leaders. Did this crisis, the pandemic, or will this crisis change anything the way the region looks into China in general?
I think it's actually just going to hasten a process which was already underway. We've seen that on the part of the public in Central Asia, it really, except for Turkmenistan, where we don't know, but in the other countries, there has been some anti-Chinese sentiment.
Yeah.
And certainly in the countries that border China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. You know, this was already becoming more pronounced even before the coronavirus came around.
Hmm.
They'll still build things in Central Asia, but they won't spend as much money and they won't build these grand projects that they did in the past. So there's going to be less Chinese money that's coming into Central Asia. And that was really what was their best PR mechanism in Central Asia anyway, was when they showed up, people in even remote regions all of a sudden got jobs on the highway crew or something, you know, but those jobs are gone. So now, you know, all there is the rumors, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but the rumors are everywhere where Chinese work. All the locals figure the Chinese are getting paid better than they are, that they have all these benefits that the local peoples never get, you know, so that's going to cause resentment. At the same time, of course, we have the dependence of the leadership, the governments on these things. So I think it widens the rift between the public and the government because the public will be more resentful and more resistant to Chinese influence in Central Asia at the same time that the governments have no choice but to remain close to
China. Yeah. Dr. Kelly, I wondered what your thoughts are. I mean, Bruce touched upon this. I mean, there was already a growing xenophobic attitude in Central Asia. How is this going to change going forward? The fact that, you know, speaking from the U.S. perspective where I'm sitting, the whole world blames China of being the source for this COVID-19, which caused lots of trouble around the world, including Central Asia. So how do you see the future of those sentiments going forward in Central Asia about China and Chinese engagement there?
Well, the first thing I would say, just in terms of, you mentioned the reliance on China, I'd probably take a slightly different look at that. In terms of economic reliance on a superpower, I would say that at least Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, probably Uzbekistan as well, have as much of a reliance on Russia just because of remittances before this happened. So I would say when it comes to jobs, Russia had probably more economic influence than China did on the whole. That's sort of just something to note there. But there was, everyone was right. They didn't do anything to change that or fix that. In terms of the sentiment, it was already so negative. I'm not sure that it changes anything for the person on the street. I think that they were already very much against China. I'd speak to anybody in Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan for my PhD research, and it was already, except for a small slice of people that had jobs, incredibly negative. We'd already seen, and Bruce is right here, the large-scale, what I call government-to-government lending is over. It's finished. But there are a few things that are online that Central Asia can do now. One is they're trying desperately to, Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are trying desperately to renegotiate their debt with Beijing. I don't think they're going to get a waiver, but it's pretty likely, I would suggest, that they can get an extension of their loans. We've seen this happen in other parts of the world reasonably frequently. So that's the first thing, at least to get some relief on the repayments for the next little bit. And that'll be the first thing that they'll look at. The second thing is the projects had already moved towards trying to boost Kazakh exports. I'm not saying just exports to China, so that they actually have something that they can produce. And you see titanium oxide factories, agriculture, which I just mentioned before, even though they're relatively small and you may not see it in the overall figures because hydrocarbons dominate so much for three of the five Central Asian states. But that's where the projects are going to be, around creating factories of some sort, localized. Maybe they export to Russia, maybe they export to China. Now, that's not going to be possible probably for the next year, just because the demand in so many countries is going to be weak. But over sort of the next 3, 4, 5 years, that's something that I think China still has an interest in doing in the region. There are a lot of companies inside China that are looking for any opportunity outside of that because they're just so desperate because of the difficult business inside China. And then the third thing that we've already seen is the way that financing vehicles work from the Chinese side. We're going to see a lot more joint investments. So it's going to be something that where you have a Kazakh partner and a Chinese partner funded by a Kazakh bank and a Chinese bank. No more of these all from one side on China. And that we've already seen that already happen before the COVID, but that's going to be the next thing. And you'll see that Central Asian states are pushing for it pretty hard.
But then,
so they're the three things that we might see slightly change. The reality is, though, unless these countries create more exports, way or another, whether it be hydrocarbons or something else, they're going to continually be in a weak spot.
Dr. Kelly, you know, the fascination about Chinese investment was that, you know, they would just put up all the money needed for any project that has to be completed in the region. So now you are talking about is it will change and no more China is going to be the ATM of Central Asia, and they will ask Central Asians to contribute. I mean, what would be the attraction of doing business with China anymore, I mean, from the Central Asian perspective?
Let me just add on that. That's already happened. You see joint investment funds now between Uzbekistan and China and Kazakhstan and China. You'll note that lending, I mean, the last time that any big deal was signed for a government-funded project, like I'm talking big, was in 2014. There's been no big deals signed in terms of government lending to governments in Central Asia since that. There's been small deals here and there, but that's already long, long, long gone. The only project I could think where you'd be looking at a single investment would be to save Talco, but I don't think that's going to be happening anytime soon, frankly. So we're going to be looking much smaller, joint finance, and things that are going to create exports. And that's just as much. It's not just China itself. It's been, went and spoke to Kazakh or Kyrgyz officials over the last few years, the road's great. Any roads that you build, great, but you actually have to export something along them. Or otherwise, these roads don't actually mean anything to us, or they have to transport something that's more a rail thing that Bruce pointed to. If that doesn't happen, then these things have no use. So there's already a push even before COVID, and the money's not going to be there for big projects after. That'll be smaller, joint financed, and less going around.
That's very interesting. Let me bring in Dr. Özcan here. I mean, the conservative China going forward in terms of the providing resources for projects that China was doing in Central Asia. Again, this is coming at a time when Central Asia is facing lots of economic constraints given the impact of the COVID-19 and then lack of remittances and lack of trade overall with all the other countries. So what all this is going to mean to Central Asia economically going forward, Dr. Özcan?
Going forward, the picture doesn't look very promising, and I think each country will have its own way of dealing with this. But If you allow me, I want to say a few things about China's operations, business operations in the region, because I was in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan doing field work and studying Chinese business operations. And I did look at a number of case studies. And that it relates to the anti-Chinese sentiment in the region as well. So the first point about Chinese operations, the business practices, is that they are very hierarchical and closed systems. So there is very little trickle-down effect at the level of labor market or the specific localities where these projects are being conducted. The fact that China does it to promote its internal economy, i.e. it has an overcapacity and uses this labor and capital in Central Asia for its own projects, means that it's more efficient for China to do everything in-house. So they do have local components, but very, very small. Therefore, their footprint in the real sense, economic benefit sense, is tiny. Secondly, these deals are often done between the leaders, and many of them are not really accountable to people. The problem with that is that creates huge aura of rumors about possible land sales to China, possible deals that are giving privileges to China. So that creates a suspicion among people that their governments are selling out their country to China without their own knowledge. True or not, but there are so many such rumors, both in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. The final point is, of course, tragedy in the camps. The fact that not only Uyghurs, thousands and hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, but also ethnic Kyrgyz and Kazakhs were taken into camps in Xinjiang. That really created a negative effect about China's image in the region. So put this on top of the issues of unaccountability, very little spillover effect, no trickle down, labor market distortions, because they go to Russia and other countries to work while the job opportunities are taken away from them by Chinese laborers. So all these things put China into a picture of a very hard power with almost no soft touch. Because of that, I think the situation in terms of anti-Chinese sentiments are likely to stay, and that may, combined with economic hardship and mismanagement, may result in further protests and instability across the region, i.e. it becomes a channel through which people express their anger. Even reflect direct protests against their government, so China becomes, in a way to express anger combined with their discomfort
We often speak about this in the context of there is obviously sort of sentiment among a certain portion of the people in all of two Central Asian countries. In Turkmenistan, it's less visible because of the structure of the government, but in other places, these sentiments emerge in this or the other way occasionally. And we often discuss this topic in the context of, imagine an election is coming up in Kyrgyzstan. Could these sentiments be used by a political party as a political slogan, where that could lead that country's relations with China? Bruce, Dr. Ozcan kind of ended her thought on in a very interesting point. Could this economic slowdown, plus with the reputational damage that China is going through because many people think that this virus has came from China and China has kind of blamed it as a cause of that, could this lead into sort of a start for a kind of more open expression of anger against local leaders by the people? Could this lead to any kind of political instability in the region? Also add to that is this economic hardship that the region is going through and will go through years to come.
Well, it was just a few years ago we saw the big protests in Kazakhstan when the rumor got out that land privatization could mean that Chinese businessmen or individuals would buy up Kazakhstan's land. So certainly it's already there. And the Kazakh government had to back off on that. And then Nazarbayev was still in power, too. They backed off on the whole thing because it was such a loaded question all of a sudden. I kind of want to go with this. This is going to kind of go around in a circle here, but I want to go with this from a different angle because we wanted to have Bradley on to talk about weapon sales to China, from China to Central Asia, right? And Dirk mentioned security was a big thing with maybe the priority for China. We get into the strange situation where China wants security in Central Asia. It absolutely has to have security in Central Asia. We're not surprised that not only weapons, but technology, you know, the facial recognition stuff, the cameras, smart cities, things like that, all this stuff is coming from China because they want the Central Asian governments that are there to stay there. They don't want change at all. So they're going to fund them. They will make sure that they never stop investing at least enough money to kind of keep these guys in business, and keep some businesses, you know, local businesses going and stuff. Give them the means, security means, to ensure that they will stay in power, you know. But like I said, at the same time, now because of this, you whip up more popular bad sentiment on the parts of the population, you know, because you're helping the government keep itself in power. You know, let's say there was hypothetically there's a revolution in Turkmenistan and you get a totally new kind of government, you know, and it's democratic or Islamic. China's dumped a lot of money in there. They could lose that and they have no idea what's going to come after that, you know, if this is like part of a domino theory or something like that. So they're going to do what they can to keep the governments in power, and that's going to keep the governments close to them, and they'll try to make sure there's enough money there so that the economies don't go under. But it's at the same time, it's going to make them unpopular with the local populations. And I'm not sure the answer is at the end. They keep pumping money in to make sure that the governments don't fall, knowing that they're becoming more popular all the time.
So. Yeah, I totally hear you, Bruce, that you know, China's interest in the region because of many other reasons will remain. What about Central Asia? I mean, earlier, Dr. Uzan, you were talking about that Europe is questioning whether diversify the over-reliance on China on a number of issues. The same discussion is taking place in the United States here. So going forward, do you think this is an opportunity for Central Asia to think of some alternative markets, alternative countries to do business with? Is there any discussion like that is taking place, given that there is less trade now? Maybe it will stay so for upcoming 1 or 2 years until this crisis is over. Do you think this is kind of a leading Central Asians to think beyond China as a kind of trading partner or political partner?
Well, in Britain, the whole discussion is centering around Brexit and the COVID pandemic. So I'm afraid Central Asia is not really very much in the public light. But I do believe that Central Asia's position may gain a new importance, especially when, as I said, dependence on China is being redesigned. There is that move, both in Europe and in the United States. We don't know how it is going to manifest itself, but that's definitely going to happen asymmetrically, not in all industries, but in certain industries, by relocating factories and production sites and service sites. And that will certainly change the economic geography of China's trade. We don't know how it is going to happen. For Central Asia, the major problem that it is landlocked and it's really dependent on Russia in many infrastructure access to West. And certainly, as we have already mentioned, its economy and politics have moved towards China for so long and so fundamentally that it is going to be difficult for the ruling leadership to change that direction. I'm also thinking in the same way as Bruce highlighted, that that is going to cause further internal conflicts, because I don't think that these regimes are going to be able to sustain their local population and livelihood. They haven't been good at it, and I don't think that they will do better in coming years. So that will mean that political change in various forms and in various shapes, maybe in the name of further national, as we see elsewhere in Europe, even in the United States, as a reactionary popular movements on the basis of nationality, national identity, nationalism, or on the basis of religious identity, or maybe a combination of both, are likely to be seen. Because to be honest with you, conditions in countries like Turkmenistan is just horrible. I mean, people cannot bear it anymore. This is not something that they can sustain any longer. So it is reaching to a breaking point.
Yeah, so in the meantime, Turkmenistan is seeing 22% decline in Chinese gas import, which is really backbone of Turkmenistan's revenue. I think we also need to be wrapping up the discussion very soon here. Maybe last point here. Whenever we spoke about, Dr. Kelly, I'm coming to you. Whenever we spoke about Central Asia, I mean, the diversification of regions, bilateral relations, trade, and politics, everything. We often thought, I mean, China is economically dominant there, and Russia is militarily dominant in Central Asia, so there's no room for any other power to come in. Now that Russia and China both are facing economic constraints, maybe there is a little trade going forward. Do you think this is a time for Western powers to try to sneak into Central Asia to put their stamp on the picture?
To be honest, they just don't care enough. You could put it one way or another. The US isn't going to get involved. They have their own problems. The EU now has its own problems as well. The chances that they're going to get involved are pretty small. Where they're going to battle China will not be in Central Asia. It will be for Europe and the US. It'll be in tech. It'll be for the US in Southeast Asia, in South Asia. Central Asia is an afterthought for them. Countries that might become more involved were perhaps Iran and Turkey. I just don't see the other countries getting involved in a meaningful way. Yes, there's always a new document that comes out from the EU every few years that will say they're going to do this, that, or the other, but every time they don't. And it's just not enough of a priority.
Very interesting. Okay, then, very last points. I will get brief comments from each of you. So what should be the takeaway out of this crisis for Central Asia going forward? Let's start with Dr. Ujjan, with you.
I think the region's governments can do better deals, China, and certainly China can offer benefits to the region in terms of technology transfer and FDI. That's how China became a global power, by basically borrowing technology and relying on FDI. So similar model can be replicated in Central Asia, but that really requires sophisticated policies, good bureaucracy, and negotiating with investors. So Central Asian governments, in my view, have not really negotiated their position with China well. That's partly because of the weaknesses of their governing regimes and their practices that are not reliable. That's one thing. I think Central Asian governments can also try to diversify their options. We haven't talked about it, but India is a superpower. It certainly has interest in the region. And it is in competition with China. Right. I don't use it in a negative sense. I think it's a good thing that India may be another anchor. And similarly, Turkey and Iran could be other anchors. Mm. And they could balance Russia and China. Now, Iran is in a difficult situation, similarly because its economy is relying on oil exports. Turkey is not in a great shape either. But nevertheless, in medium to long term, diversification to these geographies, that there are also certain cultural affinity, will be good for the region. In fact, Turkmenistan has been involved in lots of trade and migrant worker engagement with Turkey, and it actually helped to alleviate a degree of poverty in the country. Now, it's not possible because of the COVID, but yes, I think diversification is essential, and a negotiation and a strategy. They don't have a strategy. Propping up these regimes, sustaining their leadership is not a strategy for the country. They have to have a strategy for their own people and for their own economy. For the people, not for the regimes themselves.
Yeah, so revisiting their strategies might be one takeaway. Do you think Dr. Ujjan should be for Central Asian leaders? As Dr. Kelly, you were taught, I mean, what should be takeaways for Central Asia out of this crisis? What are the lessons they should learn from it?
Well, I think the first thing that they're looking at is still trying in some way to boost their own exports. Now, they don't have the industrial base for it, and we're putting hydrocarbons to one side. Their hydrocarbons, it's going to depend on the price and the demand that they can't control. But they do have agricultural goods and other things that they can at least sell something of. And once again, the country that has the largest market and is most likely to grant new market access in the near future is China. So if those deals are on the table, they're going to take them. That's the reality. In terms of diversifying their remittances, which was mentioned just now, once again, that won't be up to the governments of Central Asia. That will be up to people, individual people making their own choices, trying to escape to wherever they can. It's not going to be feasible in the next year because of COVID. But after that, the people of Central Asia will make their own choices, and they'll leave if they can, I would suggest. And then the third part is this, where they can cooperate, and it's still China that's just going to offer them more opportunities than anyone else, just because of market size, not even because of anything to do with the types of governments they are, is the capacity building in industrial capacity.
Okay.
Kazakhstan already has quite a few deals on China with this, and that's where we're going to see things, you know, being able to produce, manufacture stuff of some sort. So whether that's being sold to Russia or being sold to China, we'll have to wait and see. That's going to be sort of the big things that they want from China, and probably their best bet. I know that everyone talks about diversification, but markets are what matter. We're having the same discussion in Australia, and the reality is, for the things that we sell, there's only one market that's buying And it's no matter how we cut it, it's really hard to get away from it. Now Australia's in a very different situation to Central Asia, where the reality is they export very, very little. So anything that they can boost their exports
right.
is a positive thing. So there's no silver bullet there, unfortunately. The only other thing, and I think this goes with Uzbekistan, is anything you can do to allow free flow of capital and people within Central Asia is a good thing. I mean, the last 3-4 years, the good news story in Central Asia has been Uzbekistan compared to where it is before. That would be the biggest thing that they could actually do to help themselves.
Right. Okay, very briefly, Bruce, the same question to you. I mean, in terms of what should Central Asia be taking away from this crisis, especially when it comes to its relations with relations and also reliance on China going forward?
To kind of echo Dirk there, it's kind of out of their hands, but one, they've got to get a southern trade route together. It's just killing them that they can only go through Russia or go through China now. And so they need to do something, whatever they can, to get peace in Afghanistan, you know, get Iran, do what they can to influence Iran so that it comes into line and gets sanctions dropped, and it can be a transit, you know, route for them. That's one thing. Two, they should never, assuming that Europe and China mend their trade relations somewhere down the road, Central Asia should always remind them that Belt and Road to Europe is not possible without Central Asia, because China, for its own reasons, does not really go through Russia for Belt and Road. So the way to the West for China is through Central Asia, and Central Asia has an importance because of that. Last thing I would do if I was them is insist that China buy more finished products or goods, even commodities, rather than raw materials. If they're going to sell them a great amount of oil, then they should seek investment to build a refinery. And there is a refinery in Pavlodar. And say that you also have to buy our gasoline. And when they sell them uranium for their nuclear power plants, the El Oba metallurgical plant can produce, you know, full cycle from raw material to nuclear fuel. And they should insist that they buy that.
Right.
Some of it.
Right.
Some of it can be raw materials, but they should insist that they buy petrol and uranium, nuclear fuel, and things like that, rather than simply raw materials. So they get more money, and in some cases can pay off the great debts that they owe to China a little bit faster.
Right, right. Okay. Terrific. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. And big thanks goes to Dr. Dirk van der Kelle, the program director of policy research at China Matters Project, who is also doctoral scholar at the Australian National University. Dr. Kelle was joining us from Sydney, Australia. Dr. Gulberna Özcan, a reader in international business and entrepreneurship at the University of London. Dr. Özcan was joining us from UK today. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us in this important discussion today. And this is
Thank
from
you.
Me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.